The headlines: Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei calls on Iranian officials not to tie the country's future plans to the outcome of the JCPOA revival talks. For the first time since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, U.S. President Joe Biden says Russia is committing genocide in its offensive. And the New York City mayor calls for a change in U.S. gun laws, saying, quote, "We cannot stop the killings if we do not stop the guns." Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisoum Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on the officials not to tie the country's affairs to the JCPOA revival talk.
شما در برنامه‌ریزی‌های کاری خودتون مطلقا معطل مذاکرات هسته‌ای نشید. مطلقا. کار خودتون رو بکنید. وضع فعلی کشور رو ببینید، بر اساس وضع فعلی برنامه‌ریزی کنید. ممکنه مذاکرات به جاهایی برسه، جاهایی مثبتی، جاهای نیمه مثبتی، منفی، به هر چه بشه. شما کار خودتون رو بکنید، متوقف نکنید کارتون رو.
Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the negotiations are going well. He added that the Iranian negotiating team has so far stood up to the bullying and excessive demands of the other side and will continue to do so. Ayatollah Khamenei said the other side reneged on its pledge by withdrawing from the deal and is now helpless and at a loss. He also touched upon the war on Yemen and advised Saudi officials to stop their aggression, adding that there is no possibility of victory for them. On the issue of Palestine, the leader praised the youth's awakening, dynamism, and hard work in their confrontation with the Israeli occupation. He said the recent events showed that Palestine is alive and it will never be driven to oblivion. Iran's foreign minister has expressed dissatisfaction over Afghanistan's failure to protect the Iranian diplomatic missions in the face of violent mobs. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the acting government led by the Taliban should explain the circumstances surrounding the attacks on Iran's embassy in Kabul and its consulate in Herat. He said that Iran and Afghanistan must remain vigilant about plots by their common enemies to damage their relations. On Monday, extremist mobs threw stones at the Iranian diplomatic buildings amid protests over alleged mistreatment of Afghan refugees in Iran. A senior Taliban official said the demonstrations were held without permission and that Afghan security forces dispersed the crowds. Later, Iran summoned the Afghan charge d'affaires to protest the incidents, and Tehran has closed, of course, all consular services in Afghanistan until further notice. It says that the missions will not resume work until the Afghan Foreign Ministry gives guarantees on the security of the missions. Afghans have condemned a recent stabbing attack at Imam Rizal's shrine in Iran's northeastern city of Mashhad, extending their sympathy and solidarity with the families of the victims of all Iranian people. Rahmatullah Bahwat reports.
As a neighboring country, Iran has always been a second house for Afghans. Over 5 million Afghan refugees are living in Iran today. Following a stabbing attack at Imam Reza Shrine in Mashhad that left two clerics dead, the Afghan society condemned the move, extending messages of solidarity and sympathy with the Iranian people.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been a kind host to millions of Afghan refugees for more than four decades. Iran provides our Afghan legal and illegal refugees with jobs as well as educational, medical and other facilities. I wish Iranians enjoy peace and condemn any attack on their country, as it has served as a second home for Afghan people.
I extend my deep condolences to the Iranian people over the barbaric attack on a number of clerics at Imam Reza Holy Shrine. Not only me, but also the whole Afghan nation were saddened after the attack. The enemies of Islam and the two nations are pushing conspiracies to sow sedition, but we won't let anyone to ruin our solidarity.
Afghans also echo Iran's voice against enemies' plots and Cold War. Experts say neither the knife attacker in Mashhad represents Afghans, nor allegations of Iran mistreating Afghan refugees are true. They believe enemies of the two nations are using the media to sow discord.
The Mashhad incident that left two clerics dead was orchestrated by Takfiri groups and the enemies of Iran and Afghanistan. We should be aware that how they are trying to target our friendship. The stabbing attacker never represents the Afghan people, but it was meant to push Afghanophobia in Iran. On the other hand, the West is sowing Iranophobia in Afghanistan by fake viral pictures, while we know that Iran is generously hosting Afghan refugees.
This comes as the two nations are expanding relations in different political, cultural, and economic areas. The two neighboring countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have long been close partners. People here thank Iran for peacefully housing millions of Afghan refugees. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Moving on, the U.S. president says he stands by his assertion that Russian troops are committing, quote, genocide in Ukraine.
Yes, I call this genocide. It has become clearer and clearer that Putin is trying to wipe out the idea of being Ukraine. And the evidence is mounting. It's different than it was last week. The more evidence is coming out of it. Literally, the horrible thing that the Russians have done in Ukraine.
Joe Biden, however, says it'll be up to the international lawyers to determine whether or not the Russian forces conduct in Ukraine qualifies as genocide. Biden had earlier called for President Putin to face trial over Russia's military operations in Ukraine. Kiev claims that it has recovered the bodies of hundreds of civilians who were executed by Russian soldiers in the city of Bucha. The Kremlin dismisses the allegation as false, arguing that Ukraine has staged the videos of the bodies to pin the blame on Moscow and justify the anti-Russia sanctions. Russia's President Vladimir Putin says that the peace talks with Ukraine have hit a dead end, vowing that the military operation will continue to gain all the objectives that were accomplished.
Mind you, yesterday evening I was told that the Ukrainian side has changed something again. I'm not aware of what exactly yet, but such inconsistency in approaching key issues creates some difficulties in reaching the final agreement, acceptable for everyone in the course of negotiations. And until it happens, the military operation will continue until its full completion and achievement of the targets set at the start of the operation.
Putin made the remarks at a meeting with his Belarusian counterpart at a spaceport in Russia's Far East. The Russian president also commented on Western sanctions against his country and called the measures an economic blitzkrieg that has failed. The president called the situation in Ukraine a tragedy, but said Moscow had no other choice. He also said Western allegations that Russia has committed war crimes are fake. Ukraine says that it's investigating reports of use of chemical weapons by Russian forces in the fight for the city of Mariupol. The U.S. and Russia have been trading accusations over the one either party's using of weaponry in Ukraine. The battle for the strategic port city of Mariupol intensifies as Russia's war in Ukraine enters its 48th day. The Ukrainian army says it is, its forces continue to heroically hold the besieged city. However, the Russian Defense Ministry says its forces have thwarted an attempt to break the siege at a factory north of Mariupol. Moscow apparently wants to connect the Crimean Peninsula with the self-proclaimed Donetsk and Luhansk republics held by pro-Russian groups in the east. That's where Russia is now focused on after a month-long offensive around the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. The Russian military has been accused of committing massacres in towns near Kiev, before withdrawing from there. Moscow denies all allegations. Ukraine says more than 1,200 bodies have been found around the capital. In the latest such discoveries, officials say six people were found shot dead in the basement of a building outside Kiev. Another shooting spree in the United States. A massive search is underway in New York City for a man who shot 10 people on a packed subway train. Officials say 13 people were also injured while trying to get away from the station. Witnesses say the assailant tossed two smoke bombs inside the car and then began shooting. Some of the injured people suffered smoke inhalation. Police say that the incident is not being investigated as an act of terror, and there is no indication of a motive yet. The suspect is a black man in an orange construction vest and a gray hooded sweatshirt. Meanwhile, New York's mayor has called for changing the gun laws in the U.S., saying that deadly shootings cannot be stopped without modifying ownership laws. The European and New York stocks have fallen as official data shows the inflation rate in the United States is soaring at its fastest pace in over four decades. Major U.S. indexes, namely the Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ, were down by 0.3% each. Stocks in London, Paris, and Frankfurt also closed lower. This as the U.S. Labor Department said consumer prices have seen an 8.5% over the past 12 months. President Joe Biden has said the climbing of energy prices stemming from the war in Ukraine were the cause of the 50% U.S. inflation in March. But even before the conflict in Ukraine erupted, prices had been going up in the U.S. at record rates as the country recovered from the COVID-19 pandemic. Back then, the price hikes were blamed on a number of factors, including component and labor shortages, shipping delays, and strong consumer demand. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has apologized for breaching the COVID-19 lockdown rules and the so-called Partygate scandal, where he was fined by the police.
Say immediately that I've paid the fine and I once again offer a full apology. I understand the anger that many will feel that I myself fell short when it came to observing the very rules which the government I lead had introduced to protect the public, and I accept in all sincerity.
Despite his apology, Johnson said that he did not know at the time that the parties were breaching the law. In the meantime, Finance Minister Rishi Sunak, who was also fined by the case, equally offered an apology. Police have been investigating a dozen gatherings held at Johnson's office and residence during the 2020 and 2021 lockdown periods. Johnson would first deny such events, but later admitted to the parties. Given all this, the opposition parties are now calling for the resignation of the ministers. They say Johnson repeatedly lied to the public. The British Prime Minister has been hit by a series of controversies and made missteps in the past 6 months. And Britain is facing its biggest cost of living crisis in decades. The Bank of England predicts inflation will rise to as much as 8% in 2022 after hitting a 30-year high in February. There are even warnings of civil unrest if the government fails to act decisively to alleviate the situation for the most vulnerable. Amina Taylor has more from London.
These are uncertain times for millions of Brits. A sharp spike in the cost of living combined with stagnant pay rates mean many are counting the pennies and being forced into making stark choices.
I've got a broken back right now with metal screw and bone in my back. And the pain with the arthritis I've got is horrible. And the cost of living, of electric, and gas and petrol and food. It's horrible. You know what I have to do? Go from shop to buy cut price things which is on sale.
There's going to be people out there that are too afraid to switch on a kettle for some hot water. You know, that kettle is going to cost me 46p to boil. No. No one should be living like this. This isn't the Stone Age. I'm not going down a mine this afternoon. This is 2022.
The signs for British householders have been ominous. Interest rates hitting a record high of 6.2% earlier this year, supply issues associated with Brexit, the global impact of COVID, a spike in energy costs, the crisis in Ukraine, and a hike in national insurance contributions have all contributed. Food bank use amongst working people has hit record highs, with ever more falling into debt, according to published figures. There's a growing sense of frustration and desire to cast blame.
What the government is doing, the government has to look into this matter. They should think that what the common people will do, what they will do, they cannot survive in this country.
I'm appalled that we are left in this situation. We've just came through 2 years of COVID. And now, by the way, people, here you go, energy cap. It feels like the government is like, oh, well, you just came through hell. Here's a little bit more.
The terrifying reality is that for millions of Brits, this is simply the beginning. Flash forward a few months when temperatures would have plummeted and savings, if any, depleted. We'll start to see a real rise in half-empty fridges and bare cupboards and a growing sense of desperation, despair and anger. Boris Johnson's government says it's doing more than any other administration to lift the Brits out of poverty. On recent evidence, there will be millions who wholeheartedly disagree. Amina Taylor, London.
Italy's economy, already tested by 2 years of anti-pandemic measures, is further suffering from sanctions imposed on Moscow by members of the European Union following a war in Ukraine. Inflation in Italy continues to grow as authorities fear serious repercussions on the country's society. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Britain's oil and gas companies have reported bumper profits as the gas crisis raises the price at which they can sell their fossil fuels without raising the cost of their extraction. While they're being showered with cash, households in the United Kingdom are suffering the biggest fall in income in three decades, with one in ten households not having enough money for food and food bank use soaring. We're prepared for you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled Facts Give Lie to Claim Record Oil Money is Being Poured into Green Projects. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Chief Financial Officer of Britain's oil and gas company, BP, Murray Auchincloss, told investors recently, "It's possible that we're getting more cash than we know what to do with." Oil and gas companies have reported bumper profits as the gas crisis raises the price at which they can sell their fossil fuels without raising the cost of their extraction. While they're being showered with cash, households in Britain are suffering the biggest fall in income in three decades, with one in ten households not having enough money for food and food bank use soaring. Recently, BP reported a profit of £9.4 billion for last year, following Shell's recent announcement of $19.3 billion in profits. Little of the money is going to taxpayers. Channel 4 revealed that BP has paid no tax on its North Sea oil and gas for 5 years. Bernard Looney, the chief executive of BP, told analysts he was not seeing increased pressure for the company to pay more tax, despite calls in Britain for a windfall tax on fossil fuel profits to ease the burden of energy bills under vulnerable. Instead, Bernard Looney and other senior managers in the fossil fuel industry have sought to justify their bonanza on the grounds that the billions of extra cash is needed to pour into their transition to low-carbon companies. Facts of oil and gas company investment do not bear out the claim that the massive returns are being poured into green projects and the race to net zero greenhouse gas emissions. Chris Venables of the Green Alliance think tank said, "The time for oil and gas companies to have invested in the clean energy transition was two decades ago, when they were peddling climate change denialism. If they were serious about renewable energy, they would be doing it right now. But instead, their investments are largely going to new oil and gas. So this is a disingenuous argument." According to the International Energy Agency, IEA, investment in clean energy by oil and gas companies were about 1% of their capital expenditure in 2020, a proportion likely to have reached little more than 4% for the whole of last year. Meanwhile, the companies are continuing to invest vast sums in exploration and new fields, which the International Energy Agency, IEA, said last year could not be brought to fruition if the world was to limit global heating to just 1.5 degrees Celsius. BP plans to invest about £2 billion to £3 billion in renewable energy by 2025, but its overall capital investment will be £60 billion, most of which is likely to go into new production that will raise greenhouse gas emissions. The company is estimated to have spent about $3.2 billion on clean energy since 2016 and $84 billion on oil and gas exploration and development over the same 5-year period. We'll be right back. Bernard Looney claimed the vast majority of investment in the United Kingdom would be in the energy transition, but then admitted that this amounted to 40% of its spending budget by 2025, rising to 50% of the budget by the end of the decade. The green spending is likely also to include projects such as blue hydrogen, derived from fossil fuels that critics say produces substantially higher carbon emissions than natural gas. Shell's plans involve an estimated near-term investment of about $2 to $3 billion in low-carbon activities, which is about 10% of its investments, while spending at least $8 billion on upstream fossil fuel production. Richard Black, a senior associate at the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit think tank, says, "The key point about oil and gas majors arguing that higher profits are needed to invest in greening their operations is prove it. If they argue that that is why high profits are justified, they should pledge publicly that a sizable proportion will be invested in proven technologies, like wind power, solar power and storage, rather than blue hydrogen or carbon capture and storage, which are either of unproven potential or several years off." Richard Black was skeptical of whether oil and gas companies would do so. He said, "Past experience suggests that the oil and gas industry is strong on rhetoric when it comes to cleaning up their act, but investment is still inadequate. If they were to make these commitments with a time frame for spending and set up an independent panel of arbiters to verify their commitments, then maybe it would have some credibility." The Labour Party has called for a windfall tax to ease pressure on energy bills, but oil and gas companies have claimed it would discourage them from investing in low-carbon technologies. Green campaigners doubted these claims. Charlie Cronick, a senior climate advisor at Greenpeace, said, "Shell certainly doesn't need the threat of a windfall tax to discourage them from properly investing in renewable energies. They're already failing to do so." Charlie Cronick said, "Funding the transition is a convenient excuse to protect their bloated profits. There's no guarantee that any oil company will use the extra cash from this year's bumper profits for the green transition unless they're forced to do so. Yet the British government continues to talk up new production of oil and gas, which will only make the climate emergency worse." According to Connor Schwartz, the climate lead at Friends of the Earth, part of the problem was government failure to shift the balance of economic incentives away from fossil fuels. Connor Schwartz said, "It's clear that oil and gas companies don't intend to divert their eye-watering excessive profits to fund the green transition that we need. They have no profit-based reason to do this, because drilling for oil and gas is more lucrative than investing in cheap green energy." Connor Schwartz added, "This is partly due to government handouts in the form of subsidies and tax breaks, which reward huge multinationals for exacerbating climate breakdown instead of penalizing them." He added, "It's wrong that they're making billions while so many are struggling to eat and heat their homes. People know injustice when they see it. Any government that genuinely wants to help people out of a national crisis would introduce a windfall tax on these profiteering, damaging companies."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and He's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, you will discuss issues, relevant questions, and other fields regarding the Islamic upbringing of children. And we would like to stress that the answers that we provide in this program are all based upon the narrations of the household of the Prophet and, of course, of the Prophet himself, and upon the Holy Quran, supplemented with scientific research. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Ali Himani, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for joining us.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's my pleasure to be here in your studio.
Thank you yet again. Sheikh, last time we spoke about how teenagers, they are in a sensitive phase in their lives where they are trying to find out who they are going to be. We also said that this could also be a dangerous phase because they can also fall into the wrong groups and groupings. So as parents, as Muslim religious parents, what can we do to protect our teenagers from falling into these categories?
One of the methods that we can use or follow to protect our kids from falling into wrong company is by identifying the different characteristics and traits of a teenager. If you understand what teenage is and the different characteristics that are there as part of the teenage age group, then you can plan and strategize and you can design a curriculum or a schedule in which you can address those needs, making sure that he's not falling short or he's not being hungered to fulfill his need and go out and look for it.
Right.
So we, if you look at the scenario now in our community or rather anywhere, if you look at the scenario, you would see that parents, when they're talking to their teenagers, there's always this awkward situation. Either there's this awkward silence or the father does not enjoy the company of his teenage son.
He doesn't speak when they are
present. They don't speak at all, or even if they speak, they're not enjoying the conversation. Why? Because the father is operating at a different level and the teenage son or the daughter is operating at...
There's no connection.
There's no connection happening. Right. The example, you know, if the father tells the child, go wash your plate, go wash your dish. The food that you had in the same plate, same dish, he's not going to touch it. He's like, not my job, right? But the same child you would see in community centers after Azadari, they are, you know, cleaning up the place, they're washing the dishes, they're doing the vacuum, they're mowing the lawn. But the same thing when you ask them to do it at home, they're not doing it, right? Why? Because there's no connection happening. There's no relation happening.
There's nothing to build on upon. There's nothing binding you, unfortunately, to act upon what is being said.
And that is because of lack of analysis. You know, there's a concept called audience analysis, that you need to know who you're dealing with. You need to know who you're discussing with. You need to know who the other person is, so that when you talk to this person, you relate to this person, you converse with this person at the right tone, right level, with the right kind of words and the right kind of approach.
And of course, ideally, as a parent, you should already have that bond. Dear Sheikh, let's continue this discussion after a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how we can prevent our teenagers, our children, from clicking or falling into bad groups of people who will unfortunately shape who they will become in the future. So, dear Sheikh, picking off where you left off, we said that even when a father, he asks his teenage son or daughter to do a thing, they refuse. In a different scenario, when their friend, for example, asks them to do something, they are incredibly loyal and, mashallah, and best servant.
They would go out of their way to do things for their friends rather than for the parent. The father asks them to do something, he's not going to do it, but the friend asks him to do a tougher thing, a more difficult thing, and he goes ahead.
No problem at all.
No problem at all. And this happens because the parents are not putting in effort to create a congenial environment at home. Because the environment at home is not congenial, the child, the teenager, he wants to spend more time out of the house. He wants to be there where the environment is more congenial.
He feels he is oppressed or imprisoned.
So, and that's why if you look at the teenagers, even in the movies or the serials and the TV shows that they show, the teenager is not in the main room, not in the hall.
Always
not in the
alone, away from the family.
From the family.
If he's present, he has headphones on. Or
exactly.
He's on the phone.
Or he's in his own room playing video games.
Right.
So literally disassociating himself with the family.
Literally.
Why?
Right.
Why? Because somewhere that congenial environment is missing, that connection that is supposed to
happen.
The
harmony, the bond that is supposed
is
to exist.
And this is because the parents fail to understand some of the traits and characteristics of the teenagers. One of the traits and characteristics of the teenagers is their need, rather more than traits, I would say these are some of the needs that needs to be fulfilled. If these needs are not addressed, then the lack of addressing these needs would cause all this stubbornness, being rebellious, back answering, not listening to parents, disobeying, using inappropriate language. All this happens because some of the necessary needs are not being addressed. And one of them is the need to hang around with people of the same age.
Right.
So as a teenager, there is a need that I need to hang around with people of my same age. Why? Because I need to see what they are doing, how they are learning, who their ideal person
is. Again, this is on a subconscious level.
Sometimes even at the conscious level. So sometimes you would see that teenager, as a teenager, when they go to school, they're looking at other teenagers. For example, a kid moves into a new neighborhood. He goes to the school and he looks at all the teenagers in that school and he sees everyone's wearing a particular style of dress. Everyone's wearing a particular style of hairstyle, right?
Yes.
So immediately within a week, you will see that he's adjusted his hairstyle
this
to
them. This flock mentality even applies to adults. You do not want to stick out.
You don't want to stick out as a
even more so as a teenager.
And so, because there is a need for them to associate with the same age group. To fit in. So they necessarily immediately bring about those changes. They change the color of the shirt. They're like, I don't want to wear this shirt. Why not? I just bought this for you, $30.
Right.
Brand new shirt. No, I don't want to wear it. Why? Because nobody in the school wears this dark burgundy color or you know, navy blue color.
I stick out like a sore thumb.
And so I'll go by what everyone's going through. Right. So there is this intense need for them to associate with the people of the same age.
Right. And on that, note, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
Ya muqiya al-khayrat, ya muqiya al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Ya muqiya al-khayrat.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Dear Sheikh, just before we went on a break, you said that in people, and even more so in teenagers, there is an innate need to fit in, to go with the flow. Now, Sheikh, as a teenager, for example, in a Western society or a community that is not religious at all, but I am religious at home, will this, how should I say, that this lack of religiousness outside the home start to affect me on a personal level and my faith and iman in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
Absolutely, right? There's a term in psychology, it's called split personality. You know what is split personality? Split personality is two types of personalities living in one person, and this person is confused between which is his real entity. This is called split personality. But what you've mentioned as an example, I call that switch personality, meaning that he switches his personality based on where he is.
Is he a hypocrite? Can we say that?
You can say that. Look, if you look at it from the Darwin's point of view, he would call it adaptation.
Evolution.
Yes, he's adaptability to different environments.
Survive, right?
Survival of the fittest, right?
Yeah.
But from the Islamic point of view, as long as he is not acting in a way that is causing harm to others, we can't call him munafiq and hypocrite. What he is doing is, again, the need to fit in. When he comes home, the environment at home is religious, pious. Father is busy with prayers. Mother is, you know, the reciter. She's reciting Noha and Marcia and Mimber and eulogies and going to Azadari programs. So the son also tries to fit into that. And therefore, he's going to act religious at home, pious at home. And when he goes out, he's got all this, you know, friend circle, which is teenagers, and they're laughing and joking and cracking jokes and talking about Infinity, Avengers Infinity War, Endgame, and I don't know, all this MC universe.
Video games, music
video
also,
games
whatever
and
there is.
Call of Duty and all that. And he wants to fit into that, right? So he has to have that update that, oh, what's happening? What's new? Metaverse. What's Metaverse? I have no idea. Everyone's going to laugh at him.
Right. Yeah.
So he's going to fit in there. And when he comes home and he talks about Metaverse to his father, he's like, this is nonsense. Don't even pay attention to it. Like, it's the happening thing. I can't stay out of it. I can't ignore it. So with his friends, he's a different personality. And the moment he comes home, he switches his personality. And this is a very, very challenging state because he has to play two different personalities and he has to uphold two different entities. And that's a huge pressure on a teenager to maintain those two entities in their best form.
Some people, they call them personas, that you are. It's also naturally you act differently based upon who you are with your friends, your own age group category, people you know for years. You're much more relaxed, laid back. But with older people, for example, like we are seminary students, when we are listening to the teacher, we're like much more reserved, right? We're much more respectful. We do not joke as much. We scroll back.
Again, let me point out, when I'm talking about switch personalities, I'm talking about a total 180
degree
change.
How so, for example, if you might?
For example, let me put it this way. A pious child, a pious teenager at home, you'll find him doing, you know, all the duas and amal for Rajab, Mahe Rajab and Mahe Shaban and Mahe Ramzan. And when it's Shab-e Qadr, the night of destiny, he's awake all night reciting Quran and all that. The very next day, he's fasting, but he's hanging around with his friends. He's going to use all the F words and he's going to use all the swear words. And he's
so like a complete personality disorder, perhaps.
I wouldn't call that a disorder. It's, again, an effort to fit in. Because
it's a conscious effort, so not a disorder,
exactly,
per se.
It's a conscious effort.
But that's not a good thing, Rajshila. That's horrible.
See, this is, again, because he has the need to be part of that group, right?
Right.
If this need is addressed or managed or, I won't say controlled, rather managed is the right word, is properly managed by the family, then he would not have this urge to hang around with the friends who are, you know, not in that kind of a pious environment, right?
Because we do have a narration that says about this, as a qaran ahlil khair takun minhum. Associate yourselves with good people, you shall become of them, and bain ahli shar tabin anhum, and disassociate yourselves
from those who are shar.
Right, so it's not a good thing to associate yourselves with both groups.
Let me point this out to you. The teenager is at such an age that he is not able to differentiate between shar and the khair.
Right.
For him, this being pious is also khair, and being with those friends is also khair. Why? Because when he goes there, he does not have anyone else to mingle with, right? And he notices, he sees that all the other kids who are pious at home are same outside.
Right, yes.
So he's like, I'm part of the group.
This.
Yeah, I'm part of the group. I'm not doing anything odd and out of the place, right?
Right. Sheikh, I would love to continue this discussion, but we are unfortunately out of time. I thank you for contributing to this discussion and also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir,
Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States is forced to have a staggeringly low number of competitive House seats, an alarming trend that makes it harder to govern and exacerbates political polarization. We now present you an article written by Sam Levine. The piece is titled, America Faces Greater Division as Parties Draw Safe Seats for Congressional Districts. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. When millions of American voters head to the polls this autumn to vote for congressional candidates, the vast majority of their votes won't matter at all. It's an idea that's anathema to the very idea of U.S. government, that politicians are accountable to the people. But America is poised to have a staggeringly low number of competitive seats in the U.S. House of Representatives, an alarming trend that makes it harder to govern and exacerbates political polarization. According to 538, states have now redrawn 327 of the U.S. House's 435 districts so far as part of the once-a-decade redistricting process, and the number of competitive districts is dropping. Just 26 of those districts are considered to be highly competitive, meaning either party has less than a 5 percentage point advantage in them. Dave Wasserman, a redistricting expert for a nonpartisan Cook Political Report, predicted when redistricting is complete, there could be between 30 and 35 competitive seats. That could lead as much as 94% of the U.S. House running in relatively safe seats. As the number of competitive seats falls, the number of super-safe seats is also rising. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, as of mid-January, the number of seats former U.S. President Donald Trump carried in 2020 by at least 15 percentage points increased from 54 to 70. The number of districts Joe Biden carried by at least 15 percentage points had increased from 20 to 23. Competition in the U.S. House of Representatives has been falling for decades. Some of the decline can be attributed to the natural geographic sorting of like-minded voters choosing to live together. Dave Wasserman said in 2012, after the last round of redistricting, there were 66 districts that were competitive. By 2020, 51 districts were considered competitive. But politicians are also using their power to draw district lines to exacerbate the lack of competition. Dave Wasserman said, competitive seats are the grease that makes the machinery of the House function, and we've seen an annihilation of competitive seats in the last several decades. He added, redistricting is accelerating that decline and removing many of the incentives for parties to recruit candidates with broad appeal. The House of Representatives is becoming less biased in favor of Republicans, but it's also becoming more ossified because there will be more safe seats than ever, and the battlefield will be narrower. It's a trend that will probably profoundly affect American politics. Instead of worrying about appealing to voters during a general election, candidates are pushed to the extremes of their parties, becoming more focused on fending off primary challengers. It also discourages compromise and bipartisanship, instead incentivizing politicians to brandish their ideological bona fides. Richard Pilders, a law professor at New York University who has written about the dangers of non-competitive congressional elections, said, "I'm very concerned about what's happening. The more members are in safe seats, the more they're capable of acting as these kinds of independent free agent politicians. It could make the House even more ungovernable." The 116th Congress, which was in session from 2019 to 2021, was one of the least productive in U.S. history. Richard Pilders noted that the lack of competition also makes the U.S. House of Representatives less responsive to changes in voters' preferences. He said, "You can have a 3-point swing in voters' preferences, and it's not going to affect who's going to be elected." No U.S. state has seen a bigger drop in competition during the redistricting cycle than Texas. Recognizing Democratic gains in the state in recent years, Republicans used their redistricting power to reconfigure district lines to shore up vulnerable seats. They reduced the number of competitive districts in the state from 12 to just one. They increased the number of solidly safe Republican seats, ones that Donald Trump would have carried by at least 15 percentage points, from 11 to 21. They also increased the number of solidly Democratic seats from 8 to 12. One of the best examples of this approach is the way the Republicans redrew the state's 24th congressional district, which is the Dallas-Fort Worth area. The district is represented by Beth Van Doyen, a Republican who narrowly won the general election in 2020. Republicans reconfigured the district to make it one that Donald Trump would have easily carried by 12 percentage points in 2020. the Democrats, excised from the district, were packed into a neighboring district represented by Colin Allred, a Democrat. The packing transformed the district from one that was competitive to one that was much more reliably blue. By just moving the lines, Republicans changed two districts where incumbents were vulnerable into two safe ones. Joshua Blank, the research director at the Texas Politics Project, said, "The basics in Texas are, in most cases, the primaries determine who the victory is going to be in the general election in most cases." Joshua Blank added, "Candidates in both parties are adjusting to the new normal of having to seek support from a more ideologically homogeneous, but also more extremely primary electorate." Amanda Littman, the co-founder and executive director of Run for Something, a group focused on local races, said, "A lack of competition districts could also affect where parties choose to invest their campaign resources." Amanda Littman noted, "The Democratic Party tends to focus its efforts in places where there is overlap between competitive congressional districts and presidential battlegrounds." She said, "The fewer competitive elections there are, the fewer places that will be able to have concentrated effort and intentionality around." There is some preliminary evidence showing that the states using commissions to draw maps are producing more competitive plans. Richard Pilde said, "When commissions draw plans, you do see more competitive districts emerge than when a single party has control over the process in the state legislature." Richard Pildes also noted that there can be a trade-off between partisan fairness and competitive districts. In a state where voters are closely divided between the two political parties, lawmakers could choose to maximize drawing competitive districts or districts that lock in a split result between the two political parties. He noted politicians tend to choose the latter. He said, "You can draw a map that is fair in terms of partisan outcomes in which everyone is in a safe seat. The value of competitive districts gets sort of short shrift in the political process because there's not a lot of political self-interest in creating competitive districts."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.